IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to progress, it does not seem like the Indian government has managed to devise a concrete strategy to actually tackle the pandemic, but it does seem to have a concrete strategy to record the numbers that the pandemic is kind of recording. The sero surveys that were done over the country over the course of May have finally been released to the public now in the month of September. I have with me today Shambhavi and Sunila. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey, Anirudh.
And both Shambhavi and Sunila have some very interesting and, dare I say, somewhat disheartening information about the actual state of the pandemic today and what it might tell us about the way that the numbers are being recorded in the country. So let's first try to understand what exactly a sero survey is. How exactly is it different from an RT-PCR test? And what is the point of a sero survey as compared to an RT-PCR test?
So the RT-PCR test basically looks for the presence of the virus in the sample, whereas the sero survey looks for the presence of antibodies which are made in the body against the virus. So what happens when you have an infection is that the virus will come and attack your cells first. It will reproduce. So you can actually detect it via RT-PCR earlier. And then as the virus reproduces more copies, the body will start creating antibodies to fight off the virus. And so after a few days, you will start seeing antibodies come up. And then for a brief amount of time, we'll have both the virus and the antibodies in the within your body. And after some time, hopefully, in most cases, the antibodies win. The virus is eliminated and the antibodies continue to linger on and make sure that there is no more virus left. So the antibodies persist for longer than the actual virus. So what the sero survey actually tell us is how many people in a target population might have had the virus at some point of time for a few days to a few months before the survey was actually conducted. It does not tell us how many of them actually have the virus now, but just that say you're looking at 100 people and 20 of them show antibodies, then we can say to a good confidence interval that 20% of that population actually had been exposed to the virus. Now, it is very critical in terms of the COVID-19 to do this because we know that a lot of cases are asymptomatic. So a lot of people might not even know that they have had the virus. So this is a way of disappearing how much the virus is actually spread in a population.
Okay, so how exactly were these sero surveys conducted? Were they conducted uniformly across the entire country? Were there particular districts or towns or settlements that were targeted? And how's the sampling done for these surveys?
Right. So the National Sero Survey, which was done by the ICMR, samples were collected between May 11 and June 4. They looked at 28,000 individuals across the country. So they picked 70 districts, some districts which had containment zones, some which were supposed to be free of the virus completely, and districts within that spectrum. And this basically were picked up from 21 different states. Now, they have some complicated mathematics in the actual paper on how they picked on how many individuals to be sampled from each district. I won't go into that. But they basically presumed that there will be 1% spread. So out of 100 people, one will have COVID-19. And that's what they based their sampling strategy on. Once they picked the people, they used something known as the ELISA test, which looks for antibodies. And they used two tests. They used the COVID-19 coverage ELISA, which has been made by ICMR, manufactured by Zydus Cadila. And all those who tested positive on the COVID coverage ELISA were then retested with something known as Euroimmune test, which is another antibody test which has been developed by a German company. Now, the reason they did this was that they wanted to make sure that anyone who tests positive actually has COVID-19 antibodies only. So antibodies are like keys. So they fit with the virus in a lock and key manner. And therefore, you can have certain overlaps between antibodies that are created against the COVID-19 virus to antibodies that are created against a range of other coronaviruses. And coronaviruses are pretty common. They give you the common cold, so they're that common. And so you want to be really, really specific when you do an antibody test that what you're looking at is actually an antibody to COVID-19 virus, the SARS-CoV-2. And therefore, they did these sequential testing.
So you mentioned sensitivity, and I think another thing that's related to seroprevalence kits accuracy is a specificity, right? So broadly, when you're going around and conducting these tests, one can imagine that you don't always get a perfect positive or a perfect negative. So invariably, there are a few people who will fall through the net, as it were. Were there issues in the way that these testing kits actually worked in terms of sensitivity and specificity? And also, if you could probably just explain to the listeners what sensitivity and specificity might actually mean in the context of a test like this. So how reliable really are these numbers?
Right. So the thing I just explained was specificity. So if your kit gives you a positive result in 100 cases, then all 100 patients have on antibodies specific to SARS-CoV-2 and not to any other virus. Sensitivity basically means that if you are looking at 100 people and 20 of them actually have a COVID-19 antibody, then the kit will identify all those 20 accurately. Now, there is no kit till now which is 100% specific, 100% sensitive. But what happened with the ICMR COVID-19 coverage, which was very interesting, was that they initially said that this was an extremely specific kit. They claimed it to have 100% sensitivity and 99.8% specificity. But then eventually, in the paper that was published, and even Zydus Cadila, who was the manufacturer, themselves downgraded that to sensitivity of 92.3% and specificity of 97.7%. What we are basically saying...
Really, really big difference.
That's a really, really big difference. And I think that was... more than the fact that the kit was 92% sensitive, I think it is more problematic that the ICMR initially claimed that it was 100% sensitive.
I mean, this really seems to be pretty much in character of ICMR at this point.
Yeah.
as if demanding that hospitals should participate in a study to get a vaccine out by August 15th wasn't bad enough. Here we're looking at a situation where they're actively indulging in disinformation, to be charitable, about the accuracy of their own tests.
Yeah, and then they came out and said, oh, we made a mistake in the accuracy, which I really don't understand how that happens, but anyways. So basically what it boils down to is that out of 100 positive samples that were tested through the sequential testing, we are likely to have only gotten about 86 to 87 people detected. So there is no way that the results that came out of this survey are accurate and can actually be taken seriously.
Okay, fascinating. So that in itself is more than a little disquieting. But I believe, Sunila, you've actually done some more fine-grained analysis as to how these sero surveys were actually conducted, where they were conducted, and the actual numbers of COVID-19 cases that we might be seeing. So can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Yes, we collected data on sero surveys that were conducted at state and city level across India.
Sorry, so this is different from the pan-national survey that the ICMR has released. So this is different cities and states conducting their own sero surveys.
Yeah. Okay. So the state governments conducted the survey. We collected data at state and city level across India, and we found results through news reports for surveys conducted in cities like Bangalore, Ahmedabad, Delhi, Mumbai, and states of Punjab and Andhra Pradesh. And we found really interesting data patterns in the cities and the states. For example, in Delhi, the first round was conducted from June 27 to July 10. And at that point of time, the seroprevalence was 23.48%. The second round, which was conducted in the first week of August, the prevalence increased to 28.3%. And the third round, the official results are not yet announced, but the news reports say the seroprevalence is like 33%. So the prevalence is obviously increasing over time. We are not seeing any dip anytime soon. The highest that was found in the all of the cities, the highest prevalence that was found in all of the cities was in Pune, which was 51%, and the prevalent and the survey for that was conducted from July 20 to August 5th. But the sample size was quite small. It was 1,664. Now, these are the few of the examples of zero prevalence for a few of the cities. Now, what we did with the data was that we tried to estimate the number of cases depending on the zero prevalence of that city and the population of that city.
Sunita, so if we could just pause at this minute and kind of once again recontextualize, right? So what does it mean if Pune is being reported to have a 51% zero prevalence?
Yes. So if Pune is reported to have 51% zero prevalence, it means that when the survey was conducted, 51% of the people surveyed, they already had been infected by the COVID-19 disease. So they were found to have antibodies for COVID-19 at that point of time. Now, it is not sure if they still had the infection, but they already had been infected at some point of time when the survey was conducted. So what we did was we estimated the number of cases depending on the seroprevalence and the population of the city. And we tried to find the actual number of cases that were reported in the week of the zero survey. So when we found out these two data sets, we calculated the disparity, and the results were very disheartening, to say the least. For example, in Punjab, we found that disparity between the estimated number of cases and actual number of cases reported was 600, which means for every confirmed case, 600 cases were missed. Similarly, in Bihar, 500 cases were missed per confirmed. So this is the level.
Those are absolutely insane numbers. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine the scale of what we're talking about, right? These are all states that have populations on the same scale as like any European country.
Right.
And we're saying that there are 500 to 600 times more cases than are actually being reported as a result of this zero prevalence data. And more importantly, we don't seem to understand very well the sampling method that was actually employed in these cities to get a sense of the way the disease is spreading.
Right. I'm just going to put in context the national survey. So when the national survey was done in May, and the results were declared on June 11, they said that there was that zero prevalence was at 0.73%. Right. So just think about it. We are now looking at numbers of like 50%, 30% zero prevalence, and they were saying that, look, no, we have only got 0.73%, which is a clear underestimate. But even with 0.73%, if you extrapolate it to India's population, that is 6.4 million cases. I don't think it's a linear extrapolation. I don't think that was correctly done. But anyways, they say 6.4 million cases. And the cumulative case load on May 7, which was 3 days before the sampling was done, was 52,592. So for every RT-PCR test that was being done in May, we were losing at least 81 cases.
An important thing to note here is that when we calculated the estimated number of cases, we took into account the official population figures that were available from Census 2011. Now it has been 9 years since the last census was conducted. So obviously the population numbers are going to be more than that. So the estimated number will be even more than what we have found out.
So the big takeaway I'm seeing from this is that realistically, we actually have no idea how the disease is spreading. And we are not exactly being helped by the government in our efforts to understand it.
Yeah, so when the national survey was done, it was actually kind of touted that, look, hey, our lockdown is working. We only have 0.73%. It's not as high as some other the zero prevalence is not as high as some of the other places that are reporting zero data. And I think what we have seen over the past few months is a clear failure of aggressive testing, right? I mean, to lose even 100 cases, I mean, let alone 600 cases, basically means that the strategy that was employed first in picking who was to be tested was wrong. We did not ramp up testing facilities soon enough to allow testing of as many people as we can. Contact tracing must have also failed to a certain extent. Otherwise, we should not be losing so many cases, right? If you think that, if we go back to May, when our sampling strategy was that, at least in initial phases, was that you have to have symptoms, you have to have travel history, international travel history, and only then we will test you. Clearly, this shows that that was a wrong strategy, right? Because we have not been able to test enough people to stop the spread of the disease, and that's something we should have really concentrated on.
I think that also highlights something that we're seeing in the US as well, is that you can't develop a testing strategy purely based on optics. You can't indefinitely keep coming out and saying, hey, look at this particular statistic or compare us to this, that, and the other country. Because if you do that, then you'll continue to see exponentially rising cases, exponentially rising deaths and fatalities. And the irony in India is that even though you had one of the strictest lockdowns in the world, that second that was lifted, you had people returning to their towns and villages and therefore spreading the disease into every single corner of the country. And as you said, Doc, because we didn't have a very clear testing strategy and no clear contact tracing strategy, what has ended up happening is that the disease is well and truly out of our hands now, which is really not a good situation for a country with India's kind of healthcare systems to be in.
Yeah, it is not. And I think part of that initially may have been heavy, might have scarce resources, but the focus should have been on increasing resources, right? We knew since January that there was a disease that was novel, that was fast spreading. It was causing chaos in Italy, in Iran, obviously in China. And yeah, there is no excuse for not being better prepared. The initial reluctance of co-opting the private sector into testing, that continued strategy of needing a doctor's prescription and having international travel history to get tests done. I mean, that for me was, I cannot explain that to anybody on how that made sense.
Yeah, I fully agree. Like, even if you take the resource constraint argument, like you can't hold out, you can't use that argument indefinitely, right? It's been months and months since the pandemic has broken out, and yet we don't really see a serious increase in testing capacity. We don't really see the emergence of a solid testing strategy to go out and identify these cases, and definitely no sign of any contact tracing strategy. So I really don't know.
And instead, we have got price ceilings on testing. I don't think any of that is really helping.
So I would refer our listeners, of course, to the vaccine strategy that we put out. So let's hope at least that by the time a vaccine is available globally, that the Indian government has got its act together, and that at least then we start to see this pandemic coming back under control. Because otherwise, the only logical explanation for this is that some people think perhaps that India is going to head towards herd immunity, and therefore there is nothing more that needs to be done beyond letting the disease take its course. So what do you guys think of that idea? Like, is India heading towards herd immunity? Even if herd immunity is achieved, do you think that's a realistic long-term solution for letting the Indian economy return to normalcy?
I think we should not have the false sense of security through herd immunity, which we are apparently thinking we have achieved through the sero surveys. But the thing is that the antibodies that were detected through sero surveys, they were not the mobilizing antibodies which are actually responsible for creating immunity in our body. So that's one thing. And the second thing is we actually don't know what is the threshold for the immunity that we require for COVID-19. So it's really difficult at this point of time to say if we are heading towards herd immunity.
I'll just add to that by saying that, look, even if herd immunity is possible and you want 80% of India's population to have antibodies that will confer long-term immunity, again, something that, like Sunita said, this serious survey doesn't tell us. But even if you want to do that, it means 80% of India's population should have suffered the disease. Even if you look at the conservative estimate that this disease causes death in 0.01% of people, that for a population of 1.3 billion is a huge absolute number, right? And the question is, are you willing to sacrifice all of those people to achieve herd immunity? And I don't think I am.
Yeah, I mean, it says a lot that these massive numbers are being talked about like they don't really matter. And that's to say nothing of like even people who do manage to survive COVID, because there are some indications that there's lasting damage to respiratory and neurological systems.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially in a country like India, where you already have some of the most densely polluted urban centers in the world, the kind of healthcare toll this is going to take in the years to come is massive. And to think of the fact that India at one point was talked about in such optimistic terms because of the massive kind of youth dividend that it had, the economic potential that it was seen to have, and to see that all of this is basically being held hostage to political strategy that thinks that a pandemic can be dealt with through, you know, fudging numbers and misreporting them and relying on a compliant media to basically save the political class of any kind of accountability, it's kind of sad. And of course, I'm sure a lot of listeners might disagree with my rather bleak analysis of the situation. But I think it's important that we understand here and now that this is really not a time to be complacent. It's easy for us sitting at home to think that, you know, it's all going to be fine. And let's just wait this out until we can go back to office and go back to hang out with our friends again. But for the vast majority of the country, that's never going to be the reality. Savings have been wiped out. Jobs have been wiped out. The hopes of an entire generation are nowhere near as bright as they were at one point. And unless the government gets its act together and begins to come clean with the public and tries to aggressively deal with this pandemic, I personally don't really see this getting any better. But here's hoping, as always, that things do change and that India manages to live up to the potential for which it has always been known in the world. On that note, thank you both, Shambhavi and Sunila. Thank you both so much for joining me. And thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.